This is Spectrum, a public affairs presentation of Bach Radio Cape Cod. And now, Dennis Devers. Spectrum.
There, thank you. Welcome to Spectrum. I'm Dennis Dever. Spectrum is our weekly public affairs program here at Bach Broadcasting. We look at the issues, events, and people of Cape Cod. Today on Spectrum, we are joined in the studio by Bob Daugherty, who is the president of the Marconi Radio Club. And Bob, you are something of a Cape Codder, former, temporary, occasional. How does that work? Thanks
for
coming.
I lived on the Cape for 14 years, and presently live off Cape at this time.
Okay. The Marconi Radio Club is headquartered where?
Southeastern Massachusetts, and we have members on the Cape also.
Well, the reason we asked Bob to come by is because there's a significant anniversary coming up. As a matter of fact, it's just about here now. Something going on up at the Marconi site in Wellfleet. A very interesting commemoration of something that we count on day in and day out. It's called the birth of radio. Tell us, first of all, Bob, tell us something about yourself, how you got interested in radio.
Well, back in the days of the floor model Philco radio with a shortwave band on it, in the early 40s, got interested in radio. I learned the code by listening to shortwave bands and got a license, my first amateur license in 1955. Yeah. And from there, it's been kind of a passionate pursuit until this point.
An avocation.
Uh-huh. Yes.
What was your regular vocation, or what is?
Well, I worked as a engineer in various jobs in the military, and when that collapsed in the early 90s, I became a stockbroker, and I had a late career change in life, and that's where I retired. I retired from a large brokerage mutual fund firm in Boston.
But you did have a technical bent.
I did have a technical bent. It was a pursuit. Well, Marconi had one, too. So.
Well, Lord knows amateur radio is a very, very consuming hobby. And if you don't have a technical bent when you get into it, you quickly develop one, don't you?
That's true.
We are talking about what some people call hams, amateur radio operators. You are intimately involved with this Marconi Radio Club, which is comprised of hams, but men and women who go into it a lot more deeply.
Yes, that's true. The club was formed to represent the 1903 Marconi Wireless Transatlantic Station that was located in South Wellfleet. The first transmission that was made from there was on January 18th, 1903, and it was a message from Theodore Roosevelt to King Edward VII. And a greeting came back from the king. We believe it was by wire and not by radio. But the original station was what was known as spark gap. It's similar to almost a welding arc with a rotary disc with studs on it, but the power was 35 to 50,000 watts, and all the messages were sent in code. It was keyed on and off.
We're talking about a radio transmitter,
even before radio was called radio. It was called wireless. It wasn't called radio until, I think, somewhere around 1910 or 1912.
This is, at bottom, a radio transmitter is a mechanism that generates a very powerful electric current, which is prompted to jump a gap called a spark, and that, in turn, sends out... It sends out electromagnetic waves, radio waves, which can, in fact, be picked up at a distance. Anybody who's ever made a cat's whisker transmitter when they were young. And this Marconi chap decided that, was it first to communicate, I know in his own words, to communicate over great distances without the benefit of a wire connection. But was it shipped to shore principally, or was he looking to communicate to to land masses in other places?
Well, his original pursuit was to have worldwide communications between the countries. To have no place on the earth that you could not communicate. He did not pursue commercial interests such as David Sarnoff did with broadcasting. That was not in his pursuit of the completion of it, but to be the first one to transmit a signal across the Atlantic without any wires.
It's hard to imagine that that was an earth-shattering concept once upon a time, not very long ago.
Only 100 years when you think the Wright brothers put their aircraft up at Kitty Hawk in 1903, same year.
Yeah. So he took a lot of... he paid his dues. It was an enormously difficult thing for him to keep going financially, even physically at a certain point. And he finally succeeded from a small building in Newfoundland once upon a time, a little bit before. Was that 1901?
Yeah, 1901 in December, he received a series of letters sent in code from the spark gap transmitter in Poldo, England, series of S's. And he flew a kite with about a 450-foot wire antenna on it to receive it.
Wow.
There were many detractors, and there still are today, that say he couldn't have done it. They can prove it mathematically and all.
Uh-huh.
But he did it. And shortly after that, he took the USS Philadelphia from England with a receiver on it and received signals out 700 miles during the day and over 1,700 at night. He did find at that time that the signals were more easily received at night than they were during the day, and that was not known prior to that.
Hmm. Were these what you and I would refer to as shortwave or AM, or what kind of frequency?
Well, they were actually, it would be called, I would say, continuous wave. It was about a 240-cycle note. The keyed code had a tone to it, which was distinctive.
Mm-hmm.
It was not AM, but it was below the AM band as we know it today, about 292 kilohertz. If you think about the AM radio, it's 550 to 1600. It's actually 0.550 megahertz to 1.6, and he was down at 0.290. Very, very long wave.
And using Morse code.
And using Morse code. The voice had not been developed at that time at all.
Okay. Was Morse code in general use in 1901?
It was in general use. It came from the telegraph. They use a telegraph code.
Mm-hmm.
Morse is actually different than what is used today either by amateur radio operators or what was used at that time. They used something that was called continental code. Finally, all the countries agreed to which code and common signals for certain letters and numbers.
How does it differ from Morse?
About four or five of the letters are different. Some of them were two dots and a space and two dots, and there was too much confusion. So it was more simplified and actually made easier to copy.
Why did Marconi do his work from North America rather than from between points in Europe?
Well, he did start out, and primarily it was when he came to England, he did receive a patent. He did receive help from the British government. The Postal Service were the ones that were interested,
mm-hmm.
because they did control all the cable interests and all the cable communications. And that is where the financing came from to set the big station up at Poldo, England.
Which is in Cornwall, as close as you can get to the United States and still be in Britain.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And of course, he had set up the first. He had set up the station here with some 200-foot. They were similar to ship's masts in a circle, and they were building one also in Poldo. But unfortunately, before that happened, both of them got blown down in storms.
These were wooden towers.
Yes, they were wooden masts, actual single mast, 200 feet in diameter, about 15 or 20 of them in a circle, with an inverted cone wires leading down to the transmitter house.
Mm-hmm.
If that had not happened, probably the first transatlantic one-way message would have happened here on the Cape. But Marconi then had to prove something because he had a disaster. And it set him back at least a year or more. So he sailed to Newfoundland, flew the kite. They transmitted with a temporary antenna at Poldo, and he did receive the three S's in code. And, of course, that set up everything. If you think about this, right, up to this point, most things you could see, a cable and everything, this was invisible, totally invisible. And it's a very tough concept for people to accept.
Yeah, well, let's talk for just a moment in today's terms. We have come to accept everything from cell phones to satellite communication. obviously what you see on the television and what our listeners are listening to right now has all been enabled by this man and the people who financed him. What it must have taken to believe in him enough to come up with some money and say, go ahead, here, try this. Here's financing for another 6 months.
Well, when he first went to England, because the Italian government did not accept or did not wish to finance him, he went to England because his mother was had connections in England. She was an heir to the Jameson distilling company.
Nice connection.
And she was able to, through that, introduce him to people that would finance it.
Mm-hmm.
But when he arrived, he had a basic receiver and a basic transmitter, a spark transmitter, fixed cap, not a rotary.
Mm-hmm.
And he did some tests over a mile between the post office building and a couple of other, and another building. Then they went out on the plains area, and he successfully communicated over 3 or 4 miles. Then they went to Bristol Channel, and they transmitted from Lavernock Point to Flat Home Island, which was 9 miles across the water. Then after that, he transmitted between the mainland and the Isle of Wight, and then in 1899, transmitted across the English Channel. So he did have a good record, and he was increasing distances all the time.
So he was building up credibility, too.
And investor money.
Transmissions like this carry generally better, you said, at night. And is it true also over water?
With that unrestricted, at that frequency he was operating at, it would have. It's rather complex to understand. Frequency is related to the ionosphere, related to mm-hmm. night. Certain frequencies transmit better at night, some better during the daytime.
And do we bring the curvature of the Earth into consideration too?
Well, it's refracted. It would be similar to, on if you have to imagine the concept, putting a mirror on the ceiling,
mm-hmm.
shining a flashlight into it, okay. having a partition under the mirror that you can't see on the other side,
mm-hmm.
but the light comes down on the other side and the person can see it. So it's like reflecting it off the ionosphere.
And learning to control that.
And learning that what frequencies are the best and what time of the day is the best for the propagation to various parts of the world. Because half of the world is in darkness and half is in light at any time.
So the longer you think about communicating, the more variables you have to introduce.
Yeah, that's what makes amateur radio so interesting.
And I can hear someone in just up the road here on the Cape, or someone over in the vineyard who has a satellite dish roughly the size of a bread box mounted outside the window, chortling at this.
Yeah.
Satellite that's perhaps 20,000 miles or more away, sending MTV right down the pipe and into television by the same principles.
Yeah, we take it all for granted.
By the same principles,
yep, same principle.
As the tiny transmitter and the tiny receiver in my cell phone, which is searching, finding the best transmission and reception point, changing as I drive down the road, and still letting me communicate based on the very same principles that this chap was using a century ago.
Yeah,
ago this week.
That's right. That's right. And you wonder what the next 100 years will bring.
I wonder what he would... Bumper Morgan mentioned this a few minutes ago. I wonder what Marconi would say if he were to see what has happened with this mode of communication. Would he grasp at a whole new range of possibilities, or would he throw up his arms in exasperation?
Well, he was one for innovation. I mean, just the whole... This pursuit of this transoceanic, transatlantic transmission, with all the detractors, even in England, when at the early 1900s, when he started, came to England at 22 years old, young, not out of academia,
boy,
self-educated. He never gave up. That's the big thing with you see with these. Most of these inventors, well, the Wright brothers, or Alexander Graham Bell, Edison, et al., You know, Edison commented one time when they were looking at on various filaments, he said, and it failed, one of their tests failed. He says, well, now we know 1,200 things that don't work. They have this persistence and perseverance that carries them through. They're never discouraged. It's a remarkable characteristic because there really aren't many people that have it. Then or even today.
You think of Armstrong with FM radio and Farnsworth and his Russian counterpart with television. They simply did not relent.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. They believed in themselves. That was a big factor. They did believe in themselves.
And so to honor this and observe this little slice of time, 100 years that has passed since it first happened from Cape Cod to England. You folks have built a transmitter. You're replicating the same kind of transmission that was used then.
Well, it's similar. One of our members has built a small fixed-gap transmitter, which is exactly the same as Marconi used when he came to England. We've found all the diagrams in a book printed in 1933 from one of his chief engineers.
Wow.
His name was Vivian. And one of the members, Dave Riley, lives in Marshfield. His call sign is AA1A. Built this Cohera receiver with a spark gap transmitter. The spark coil that we have, it's a Rumkopf coil. This coil was invented in 1850 in Germany. And it makes an arc similar to a welding machine. Mm-hmm. It's a very small arc, only maybe a quarter of an inch or so. The receiver is a Cohera. It's a glass tube with some metal filings in it. A Frenchman named Branly developed this in about 1890. It's hooked up with a relay and a doorbell transformer and a telegraph sounder. There is no sound code comes through. So all you hear is the clicking of it. Well, Dave put this thing together. He filed a nickel, took a little silver off some silverware his wife had given him, some filings, put it in an old glass fuse tube, and we were able to transmit about 10 or 15 feet across the room with this. And now that will be at Coast Guard Beach, where we'll have the transmitter. That will be demonstrated there.
Yeah, we are. I should remind folks, we are focusing on the Marconi site in the National Seashore in South Wellfleet. Used to be Camp Wellfleet and a lot of other things, but now it's a wonderful destination for folks. If you have company coming this summer, especially if they have youngsters, a wonderful spot to take them to because it's very, very evocative, besides being fascinating. It's a place where you can stand and look in the direction of Cornwall and think about that cold January night in 1903 when daring took the place of conservatism and dreams took the place of reality and daring dreams came true. And it's wonderful that you folks, you have, I want to say you guys, but I gather there are men and women both in the Marconi Club.
Yes, there are. This is a joint effort between the Marconi Radio Club and the Marconi Cape Cod Memorial Club, which is the main officer is Ranger Barbara Dugan. She's a ranger at the park. She has her amateur radio license. And her group received a grant to purchase amateur radio equipment. Towers, antennas, beams, and all, and we would enough to equip two full stations. In the future, there will be a permanent amateur radio station with the call sign KM1CC Marconi Cape Cod, and this will be located somewhere within the seashore. It hasn't been decided yet where it will be, but our present operation will be from Coast Guard Beach, from the former Coast Guard station. There are two towers there erected already with high-frequency antennas on them. And we'll be presently operating from there.
Sending and receiving.
Sending and receiving. We will be capable of worldwide communications.
Gee whiz. So you've probably done a lot of coordination with folks for this observance in Britain.
We've contacted the clubs that we've in Cornwall and also in Poldo.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know if there will be a return message from the Queen.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, it would be. It would be great if we could do a full, complete exchange between President Bush and Queen Elizabeth.
Edward VII, I'm afraid my memory of history fails when I try to think of the connection between Edward VII and the Queen, but there is a very real connection, obviously, besides just the monarchy. This is fascinating stuff. You have... tell us something about what you use at home as a ham radio operator, what your equipment is like. Is it terrifically expensive, very involved?
Well, it's as expensive as you want to make it.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy a small kit that would run maybe 5 watts of similar power to a Christmas tree bulb with a transceiver kit for $150 and get some wire and put it up in a tree, and you'd be capable of talking to Europe with that. It would be on code, not on voice, because
mm-hmm.
the code is far more efficient to use. My station is a transceiver. It's about 200 watts.
Ooh.
And I also have an amplifier, which is about 1,500, which I can use on code or voice. I have a 68-foot tower in my yard, which tilts over. It has a high-frequency antenna on it and two VHF antennas. It can be rotated. I also have various wire antennas.
Does anything happen to the neighbor's television or microwave or kitty cats when you're on the air?
No, nothing. I don't know. Most people have cable today, and most of the TVs of that are if they're using outside antennas, I'm really not affected by it as much as it used to be years ago.
So ham radio operators are, if anything, they're certainly good neighbors.
Well, there's always a controversy about height of antennas.
Yeah.
If you want to eliminate interference, the higher the antenna, the better for any type of television interference.
But you do have to be conservative to keep an acceptable profile in most neighborhoods.
That's correct.
I think of David Sarnoff and the signals that were sent from the Titanic in 1912. How he had difficulty getting people to believe that he was actually receiving those signals. And, of course, there came a delay, and he was not, eventually, he was not one of the ones who was responsible for getting the word out, so much as the closer ships were.
Right. It's remarkable because we have the spark gap from that station in Siasconsa.
Gee whiz.
One of the amateurs, Fran Pease on the Vineyard, mm-hmm. his wife's grandfather was the one that secured that from the station, and he's had it for years, and that is the one is on the model that we have built, that Dave Riley built.
Wow.
Has that original piece of equipment. It still operates from 1901.
Well, the Centennial Observance from 1903 is going on this week. It culminates Saturday, as a matter of fact, the 18th. And folks stop by and see what's going on?
Oh, yes. And we encourage them to come.
Grand.
We encourage them to come by. There'll be a lot for them to see.
Coast Guard Beach in Eastham.
Right. And also there'll be activities at the administration building in South Wellfleet and also out at the site.
Gee whiz. Bob Daugherty, thanks for joining us. I'm afraid the time is all up. Bob is the president of the Marconi Radio Club here in southeastern Massachusetts and involved in a very a remarkable celebration, a centennial celebration, all this week, as a matter of fact. The birthday of, thanks very much, radio. That concludes this week's edition of Spectrum. It's heard every week here on our Bach Broadcasting Stations. We hope you'll join us next week for another edition of Spectrum. I'm Dennis Derrick.
This has been Spectrum. 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 Spectrum.